Willkommen zum FAZ-Bücher-Podcast von der Frankfurter Buchmesse. Und am FAZ-Stand ist nun der Autor John Burnside zu Gast. John Burnside spricht mit Jan Wiele über sein Memoir. Und das heißt, über Liebe und Magie. I put a spell on you.
Ja, schön, dass Sie gekommen sind zu diesem Gespräch mit John Burnside, den wir herzlich begrüßen. Das Gespräch wird, soweit das möglich ist, in Englisch stattfinden, aber es wird vielleicht manchmal auch um einige Begriffe gehen, auch lyrische, die so ein bisschen dazwischen liegen, lost in translation sind. I'm going to say good morning to you. It's just about hair of the dog time, I would say, at the book fair. And yeah, I think. And in your book of musical memoirs, as I would call it, there is one scene. It goes back to the 70s in Cambridge when you first arrived, if I'm correct. And it also talks about breakfast and what to have for breakfast. And it's, if I remember correctly, it's mackerels from Portugal in oil.
Yeah. Well, it's not what to have, it's what not to have, really, in a way. I was trying to give a little kind of pen portrait of my life then, and I tried to live a very simple life, and I mostly lived on milk and canned fish and a few other small things, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, if we talk about memoirs, I don't know if you like the term memoir too much, but this goes back in the beginning of the book to an afternoon, a Saturday afternoon, way back. It's kind of a way back machine, this book. And you say when you first listened to the song I Put a Spell on You by Nina Simone on the radio with your mother, that was the most beautiful thing you ever heard.
Yeah, it was. I wanted the book to really be about how pop culture, if you like, I don't like these terms, but that's what we use, can influence a life all the way through a life. And for me, the first time it really made a difference was I had a beautiful cousin. She was very elegant and she was very stylish. And in those days, I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember this, she was what they call a mod. No, you're not old enough to remember mods. But anyway, but you've seen them. Oh, okay. Mods were very stylish. And they used to have, the ladies used to have beehive haircuts and wear these black and white clothes, and they were very, and she used to have different clothes and different hair all the time, and she kept changing them, and she always looked different. So she was like my kind of heroine, if you like. And she had a husband called Jackie, who was a merchant seaman, and he used to say really rude things in front of my mother, so he was like my hero. And they used to come over to my house with music, with songs, and play them to my mother, because my mother liked very kind of old sentimental things, like, you know, Frank Sinatra and those kinds of things. So one day they came with a little portable record player, and they played I Put a Spell on You by Nina Simone. I thought it was written by her, because I found out later it wasn't. But I listened to this thing and I just thought, this is the most beautiful sound I've ever heard in my life. And so I started listening to this kind of music. And so this was in the 1960s. And this book, it goes through my lifetime by way of different songs. And some of them are famous songs and some of them are not so well known. And, you know, it's just a lifetime in songs, maybe.
Yeah, in another book of yours, it's called Waking Up in Toy Town.
Yeah.
There's this phrase that's saying, to construct a whole other world from songs. So it's, to me, it's kind of like your Proustian moment is not Madeleine's, but it's really musical moments in the past. And one thing I thought about, we have a term in German journalism, it's called Berufsjugendlichkeit. It kind of means you're young at heart in a way, you're a professional youth. And these days we talk a lot about whether rock music is dead or if it's actually what it means that people in getting older, they reminisce about pop and rock music all the time. But I think reading your work, it's really you're rather serious about this.
It's about rock music?
No, about the intertwined memories of what it means to construct your whole existence in lyrics.
I think I would probably like to use the term folk music, folk culture, but by which I mean, I don't mean like dancing around the maypole. If you say folk in Britain, it means you wear funny hats and you dance around listening to people with fiddles. But any kind of music produced by the people rather than by producers in a kind of a commercial studio planning how they're going to shape the taste, it's folk music, it's the expression of the people. So for example, in one of the chapters I have a quote from probably a band that nobody, let's do a straw poll of the audience. Has anyone heard of Plants and Animals? Raise your hands. No. But they're a great band, they're from Canada. Really, really good band. If you get a chance to hear them, listen to them. Plants and Animals. And they're folk music for me. They're regular musicians, a bunch of guys who got together and played together and decided to make a record or two and then moved on to other things. You know, that's what music really should be like. It shouldn't be, you know, shaped by an industry in the way that it often is, and certainly in the UK. You find your pop stars in the UK by running TV shows and choosing the ones that, not the ones that are best singers, but the ones that are more glamorous or they have an interesting backstory. We do that with writers too, of course. Glamorous, interesting backstory writers are good too. But, you know, the kind of spontaneous expression of the people at any one time is what I would call kind of folk music. And that's part of the fabric of reality.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's so much outside noise. People are asking if you might get closer to the microphone.
Closer to the microphone.
Yeah, that would be so nice.
Sorry.
Okay. And I was wondering, in Germany, we have mostly poems from you. You're a renowned poet. And now this book and some other books of yours are about music. So is there an aesthetic difference for you between lyrics and poetry?
Yes. In the sense that when I was growing up, you know, I grew up through the 70s, and you had certain singers, and they say, oh, he's so good, or she's so good. They're really a poet, like Joni Mitchell, or Bob Dylan, or Neil Young. They're really not just a songwriter, they're a poet. I said, what do you mean, not just a songwriter? Songwriters do two things. They write music and words. Poets only do one thing. They write words. Yeah? So I've always disliked that kind of thing of saying, oh, poetry, it's somehow part of the high culture, and songwriting is more like popular culture. I think that's really silly. And I think most poets, if they were honest, aspire to write songs. And we come as close as we can, except other people can play the guitar or the piano better than we can. But it's all the aim is always to create music.
Has any of your poetry ever been set to music?
Yeah.
Can you elaborate a bit on it?
No. No, I should. But a couple of times it's been really interesting. One time there was a guy called Norman Blake from Teenage Fan Club, the Scottish popular music combo. He wrote a nice version of a lyric that I'd written, planning to write for music collaboration. He did one a nice one. Sometimes you'll take poems and they make them into songs. It doesn't work so well for me, because for me all the music in a poem is in the poem. I think it's when you write a specific lyric for a song that's more successful. So when I've written a few lyrics, I think that's been, you know, that's worked better.
If I come back once to the Nina Simone song, I Put a Spell on You, you say you actually rather like the version by Screaming Jay Hawkins. Why is that?
Yeah, it's one of those things. Nina Simone's version is a classic. It's a work of brilliant, it's a brilliant performance. And I love Nina Simone, she's just great. And in fact, as a figure, she's much more important than to me than Screaming Jay is. But when Screaming Jay Hawkins made that song, it's an expression of what I like to call Thrawn genius. And the word Thrawn in Scottish means misshapen, strange, irregular, crazy. And I like to think that that Screaming Jay brings out the crazy part of me, the Thrawn part of me. But he originally wrote that song as a kind of commercial ballad. Mm-hmm. You know, he just wanted to write a song, and he had his girlfriend, and she left him. And Screaming Jay had a rule: the girlfriend doesn't leave you; you leave the girlfriend. So she left him, and he was very annoyed. So he wrote this song as a kind of little joke about that. I put a spell on you because you're mine. You better watch the things you do.
The way he sings it sounds very vindictive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the final version, but the first version he planned was like a ballad. So it was just like a piano ballad. You know, I put a spell on you, and then they tried to record it, and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work. So they said, "What should we do?" And he said, "Get some booze." So they filled the studio full of liquor. Everyone got blind drunk. And then they played this version that they recorded. Like, I put a spell on you. And then, you know, he was really drunk when he did it. And it works beautifully. It's scary. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that woman left town. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I was thinking if there's a big metaphor in that song for your whole work. Because if we go back to the Nina Simone version, it's kind of, I don't want to call it depressive, that would be demeaning, but her voice is so melancholy, especially in that song.
Yeah.
If that is a metaphor for the whole, how lyric and the what I call Proustian memories of pop music in early youth kind of puts the spell on you. And I'm also wondering if with age, everyone is kind of moving towards the Nina Simone version of the spell.
Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe they're all working towards the Screaming Jay version.
Oh, so it's the other way around. Okay.
Maybe, yeah. So. I think this is my favorite of my books. And I think this is the most hopeful of my books. Mm-hmm. But it starts from a premise that says, to get to the position of being hopeful, you have to get rid of illusions, the cheap illusions that were sold, so that you can build something else that's more interesting. I grew up in a working class community where the boys all knew if they got married to the girls that they fell in love with, they would be stuck forever in this town, and they'd have to get a job in the factory and stay there forever and look after the wife and the four children or the eight children or whatever they would have. And so all the boys didn't want to have love affairs, but they didn't want to get married. And then the girls were all trained from years dot to get married and build a house and a home and have eight children and all of those things. They didn't really want to. They wanted to have some fun too, like Cyndi Lauper said. But that's what they were trained to do. And so you had this conflict. People were getting fed to them all the time by the radio, songs about everlasting love and, you know, I will love you forever. If you leave me, I'll die. I mean, you know, I've never said that. Can you imagine saying that to someone? If you leave me, I die. I mean, I could imagine saying, if you leave me, I'd be quite upset. But there are plenty of fish in the sea, so it's not so bad. But I can't imagine saying, please don't leave me here. I'll never exist again as a human being. And these songs were all about this. And I said, why? Why do they make songs like that? They're obviously false. It's not a nonsense idea. And of course, it's to try and propagate this idea that you would want to fall into this trap of, you know, working in a factory at a place called Corby with eight children, etc. Those are all the illusions. Some of the illusions we choose for ourselves, some are imposed upon us. But we can push them aside. We can still have beautiful relationships with each other, interesting relationships, in which there's a degree of freedom. And that we won't be trapped by the capitalist system. We won't be trapped by the capitalist system. I mean, the reason for the nuclear family and the way it currently works, for me, was the way capitalism works.
Well, thank you for that wonderful answer. it goes way back. If I think about your poems, your written poems, compared to this, you once said talking about Glenn Gould, he has this phrase, Einsamkeitsquotient. A solitude quotient. Yeah. For every major artist, there is a solitude quotient. And if I think about poems like the ones in this book, Versuch über das Licht, which is a very fine volume of poetry, I think, there's, I mean, you say pop music is about mostly about being left or being left alone. In your poems, it's mostly a soul creature in nature who is left alone. And can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, I mean, I think it's... I think we all do have some kind of solitude quotient, and some are much higher than others. I really prefer to be alone most of the time. And I think, with the possible exception of my children, I'd probably spend the rest of my life alone if I could, because I just like my own company. But some people feel exactly the opposite of that. They want to be with other people all the time. So it's, that quotient idea is quite a good one. When you said about this idea of the lone person in nature, it made me think it sounds a bit romantic, even German romantic. But it's not entirely like that, I don't think. I think the main thing is that when you're alone in the natural world or anywhere, you're more attentive to what's around you. You're paying attention to the things that are happening around you, as opposed to the people you're with. Or, you know, no matter how hard we try, when we're with other people, we have to conform to certain social expectations, some of them very subtle. Whereas if you're completely alone, walking in a forest or on a beach or on the tundra somewhere, you can just be open to what's around you. And in fact, it's not so much being alone, it's almost like you disappear. And that's been my kind of ambition for many years, is to actually to disappear completely. And then, you know, to go out, for example, into a forest and never come back, but still be there somewhere, you know.
Yeah, in German we only have the word Einsamkeit, but I think, yeah. Glenn Gould talking about solitude, so you would actually make a big difference between solitude and loneliness, I guess.
I've never been lonely. And I was trying to figure this out recently. I was invited to take part in this kind of discussion in London, and it was a kind of humanities thing with a lot of sociologists and people, and it was about solitude, and I thought, oh great, I can talk about that, I love solitude. And I was going on about how wonderful solitude was, and it turned out that the whole thing, I didn't prepare very well, obviously, the whole thing was about the growing epidemic of loneliness among young men in Britain, I'm sure here as well. And I was sitting there saying, isn't it great to be alone? Isn't it wonderful to go out and just be alone and forget? And all these guys were sitting there sobbing in the front row, saying, I'm so lonely. And I thought, I don't understand you. Why are you lonely? What does it mean to be lonely? You know, I don't know. I've never been lonely.
Without sounding too pessimistic about culture, do you sometimes think when you look at younger artists' work that they don't spend enough time alone?
No.
You don't think?
No. It's quite interesting. We've been in a big discussion about poetry in the UK. I just brought out a book in the UK about poetry. It's a kind of history of 20th century poetry. And I wrote it purely as a response to... I got sick of hearing people say, poetry is dead, nobody's paying attention to poetry anymore, blah, blah, blah. Some guy said that poetry was so badly off now, it was less popular than knitting, singing in groups, and jazz music. I thought, jazz music? I love jazz music. What's wrong with jazz music? So I wrote this book. And the main idea in the end was to say, poetry has never been healthier than it is right now, you know, across the world. And I said, maybe in some parts of Manhattan or London, say, people are thinking this, but there are poets out there, and I was talking about people in Singapore, in Africa, Native American poets, whoever, across Europe. Poetry right now is rich. And it's a different kind of poetry than the last generation. But then so was T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, right? So I don't believe that the younger people, as it were, are you know, absorbed in their social media or not, you know, getting into their souls. I think they're just as, maybe even more so, connected with the world than my generation.
Well, thank you for this very hopeful answer.
Absolutely. Hope is
I can tell you that jazz, like if you talk about jazz music in journalism, that about if you talk to controllers, they don't like that at all. It's like they say it's a topic of special interest now. And
well, it shouldn't be.
So I think for some people, poetry is as well. But I'm happy to hear that for you.
There's only one thing I would say is there's a danger that people do is they take things that are of special interest and say, okay, we'll get an audience by putting them together. So there used to be a thing in Britain of poetry and jazz. That is one thing to avoid. Jazz music is great. Poetry is great. Poetry and jazz together is horrible. Really horrible.
I'd like to hear a bit more about that. We have about 2 minutes, but that is a fine topic.
Well, you know, it's... what do you do when you go to listen to jazz music? You want to hear the music. What do you do when you listen to somebody saying a poem? You want to hear the poem.
So, but you just wipe away the beat poets in one strike then? Or?
No, as poets, they're cool. But when you've got somebody sitting in the background tinkling the piano keys, if you want proof, on YouTube, go on YouTube and you can see Jack Kerouac saying a poem with Mike Wallace, or whatever his name is, playing the piano behind him. You know that one? And it's ridiculous. It's like, let the man speak. Play the piano. Yeah, sure, but another time. He's trying to say something. Don't play the damn piano. Imagine if every time you try to say something, some guy turned up and started playing the piano in the background and said, shut up, I'm trying to speak here. You know, so it doesn't work together. But they're both wonderful. And we should all be listening to jazz for sure. Again, like poetry, jazz has never been richer. Jazz is... You know, we haven't got John Coltrane, but we've got lots of other lesser geniuses, especially in European jazz. And Germany is a great jazz scene, for example. Mm-hmm. So,
thanks again. And to end with, I think that nobody will ever try to set your poems to music again after listening to this
Not
talk.
Jazz, for sure.
But everybody should actually read your poems and read the Proustian memories about love songs in the 60s and 70s that go back into our hearts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.